Now here we go.
Most people really don't believe me. I know that. I live with that every day of my life. I've been pretty well tuned out by the media. If anything is remembered of me, I guess in the general world, what they remember is, haha, rectal probe, or he's a disturbed man, he's crazy, or something like that. But the truth is, I am not crazy. This is about emotions and feelings more powerful than human beings experience. It's about living and facing such experiences, and it is hard. It is real hard.
Bad things have happened to people from my childhood who I returned to meet again. I think I was traumatized in early childhood, and I don't think I'm real alone. I think the whole neighborhood was bruised as if an invisible fist had come.
And also, I want to go home.
I don't think that I did it. I don't know what I did exactly connected with this in terms of intelligence work.
I can't get that face out of my head.
Apparently nothing. I can't remember anything at all. Not even a snatch of anything.
Really?
You will not live if you join the CIA. But I am a very conventional person. I was not able to control what happened. As you're undoubtedly aware, there's a whole school of thought in our world that they're evil. And they wouldn't disagree with that for a minute. Dark side and evil are complicated issues. We make the dark side evil by the way we deal with it, and the grays will test you and test you and test you. The more you work with the dark side, the more successful you are, the darker they get. Until you find the only thing is surrender.
Because I cannot do a thing about this. I don't even want to look up at this.
The only thing is surrender.
Can we help you stop screaming? Can we help you stop screaming?
I had this dream last night. Really intense, you know, those nights where you seem to just be dreaming all night long the same sort of narrative. Mm-hmm. And it was like an investigation into my past and revisiting my past, particularly a period when I was at boarding school. I was only at boarding school for 2 terms, and I didn't like boarding school at all. But it's also the period where I do have these weird anomalous memories. I don't know if you listened to my talk with Doug Lane that time where I mentioned I had these weird anomalous memories of going out in the middle of the night with these kids in my dorm and running around with white sheets in a field. That was that period, and I've never accounted for that memory. I just don't know whether it's real, and if it is real, what we were doing. And I also know from letters from that time, this is about 10 or 11, that I saw a UFO because I wrote home about it. I have no memory of that. And that's actually in the piece, actually, I incorporated into the piece, those little details. But anyway, my dream last night was about that period, and it had to do with following these clues, finding and following these clues that were incredibly realistic, but they weren't accurate. Like, what I remembered of the dream, none of the stuff, none of the clues that I dreamt about following were actually real, part of my past. But in the dream, they were just very detailed kind of clues, so they had that realism to them. It was really very much like a process. It wasn't like the sort of chaotic dream scenario where things are morphing and changing. It was very linear, seemed very rational what I was doing, just that, as I say, it didn't actually intersect with my actual memories. But I was following these clues and I was discovering more and more evidence for the fact that something terrible had happened to me during that time, and it had to do with Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, because I grew up in Yorkshire, and he was killing people around the time I grew up, I think in my teenage years, and he had taken refuge in the school, in that boarding school. And Jimmy Savile had been there, and then he'd been covering for him. That's about all I can really remember, except for the general mood was this just increased feeling of horror as I began to realize that these incidents had happened to me in my past that I'd completely blocked out. And it wasn't that something had happened to me directly in the dream, it was that at least the first thing I got to was that I'd found a body. I found one of the murder victims of the Peter Sutcliffe, and you know, been mutilated, and so this has been a really horrific experience for me, finding this body. That was obviously symbolic. I didn't think there was any literal truth in that as far as Peter Sutcliffe or me finding a body, but the symbolism of finding a body is pretty acute in itself. The lost body of childhood, is what Brown calls it. But overall, I think the mood, what felt real to me was the mood of it, that there is something in my past that has been forgotten, that's been suppressed, that is horrific to me, that was horrific to me, it's traumatic. And I guess, going back to your question, the closest I'd come to interpreting that previously was that it was some otherworldly encounter, you know, with otherworldly entities. I never really felt like there was sort of mundane human physical intervention. I still don't know if there was, but the alien thing was always felt good, put it that way. Like, I thought, oh yeah, something bad happened when I was a child, or something terrified me, but it was this, it was something that kind of marked me out for cosmic specialness, some sort of divine intervention that was terrifying, but nonetheless was divine. And I just saw, the more I've looked into Whitley's story, the more I've seen what I think is that tendency to spiritualize trauma and turn it into something that's much more palatable, while at the same time more improbable, more fantastic.
That's the only thing I have, but you have to ask yourself, why would a child's immune system shut down? Okay, now here we go.
Maybe I should turn this around. I mean, what's been yours? You've only read two chapters so far, but what's been your kind of response to it? Like, how do you perceive it as what I'm doing?
Well, I've kind of had, you know, other than the enjoyment of reading it, I've had some feelings like, why is he doing this? You know, this is this is something that is superfluous in its own right to the basic thing that we were just kind of talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Those are kind of things that pop up, but they don't necessarily overcome the experience of reading it, because there's a more to it than that, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I have had a few things like that. And I have had a few times where I was reading it and I was alone, and I have that sort of feeling, you know, where you think there might be an earthquake or your house is going to fall down. So you're on the edge, sort of excited, you know. I think it just reminds me of the chain of, you know, I guess memories of that feeling. And a lot of them have to do with, you know, Whitley Strieber and aliens and unhumanness and kind of unreality. So it just wakes up that chain of memories, and then you can just, you know, fall into it.
So when did you first discover Strieber's work?
It must have been 2005. I was in high school, or no, I was just in college, out of high school for 2 years.
19 or something?
Yeah, something like that. And yeah, that was basically it. I discovered, I think, Communion first, and then kind of went through some of his other stuff.
And what was your initial response to Communion?
I was pretty absorbed in it, and pretty absorbed in a lot of books at the time. And I had a lot of those experiences and a lot of strange things. What I felt were strange.
So what do you mean by those experiences?
Just like that. When you're really on the edge, feeling of unreality, like something terrible has happened or is going to happen, the world is about to rip open.
Huh.
But it doesn't happen, obviously, because it rarely happens.
Is that an experience that you had when you were a child?
Yeah. I mean, I think it kind of makes a chain of memories back to the early days when I don't have much of a memory as far as, you know, I wasn't reading any books back in those days when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. Was it a feeling that something terrible was going to happen, or something big, or both?
Both. I mean, usually it's kind of like you feel like something's going to tear in your perception. It's all going to be, all hell's going to break loose, kind of. Reality-wise, you know?
Well, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I don't know if...
I used to think it was like schizophrenia or something.
Yeah, well, it may well be similar to what people diagnose as schizophrenia experience.
Back then, I had a lot of dreams about things that weren't necessarily even alive, but they were so strange that I would see them, and I just, you know, it was just so strange. You can't even see it, really, because it's too strange. You just can't. You're running because you're afraid of it, but you don't even know what it is. It's just something you've never seen.
Right.
But it's a machine or something like that, you know? But, yeah, I used to see, like, these black and white kind of weird machines in my dreams, and they would bring on that feeling quite a bit. But they weren't like people at all. They were more like discs.
Huh.
It's weird.
Was this before you read Strieber?
No, I think that was after that I had those particular black and white machine dreams.
Did you have any more sort of traditional entity dreams?
Yes, but not as traditional as seeing like an alien face or, you know, a gray or anything like that. It was more just encounters with people you can't see but speak to you,
mm-hmm.
let you see stuff and things like that.
So how much would you say that you were influenced by Strieber's writing?
I think that I was, like, the influence of his books was partially because he's a good writer, and he, you know, you can be engulfed in the experience of reading his book, and partly because of my overarching research project that, you know, his books were a part of for me. Like, they were an integral part in, you know, kind of opening up a lot of possibilities, and, you know, they were part of a big change in my perception of my day-to-day life. My feelings towards Strieber is like fondness, for lack of a better, more detailed description. I'm fond of the guy. I'm fond of his work.
That's a word that I would use and have used in the past, a feeling of fondness for him. To be honest, like, the deeper I've gone into him, his work, which is really all I've got to go by, if you include his audios with that, the harder it is to retain that fondness. But it's still there. I mean, it's like a family member or something. I mean, I guess I always felt an affinity for him and a deep sympathy. I think it invokes sympathy with his writing. I discovered Whitley at a time where I was just becoming a seeker, really. Like, it was just after Castaneda. I was in Mexico. It's an odd kind of memory of discovering Strieber, because I don't remember what I was doing in this place. I was living in this forest somewhere, in this sort of stone hut, and I rented it for a month or 2 months. I don't remember why, though. I must have just wanted to get away from the city or something, because I was in Oaxaca before that, which is where Castaneda's books took place. That's why I went there. And while I was in Oaxaca, there was a magazine shop that sold American magazines, and I saw a UFO magazine. And I hadn't had any interest in UFOs since I was like 15 or something. And so I bought the magazine anyway, and then I had it. And it had an article on Ed Conroy's report on communion. So this was 1990 or 1989, so it was well after communion, but Ed Conroy's book must have just come out. And so it was about that. So it was sort of once removed or twice removed even, but probably had the picture. No doubt it would have had the picture of communion cover. That was it. I had to read the book. I was in Mexico, so there wasn't much chance of finding it, but I was in San Francisco soon after that. I must have read it in the night or something. Knowing me, I just swallowed it whole. Within a day or a week of reading it, it was as if I'd fully assimilated Strieber's experience or his account of it, and taken it totally to heart. Like it had stirred a memory or something, not literally, but in the way that I just so quickly took it on. I became infatuated with the thing, I mean, like, with these beings. Like, I began to dream about them, I began to have, like, visitations of sorts, not very many, but several experiences of not waking up, but being about to go to sleep, and then rather than falling asleep, and entering into this different state, and where I became aware that there was something in the room, at the bed, at the end of the bed, on the bed, this incredibly super conscious entity that was putting its attention on me, communicating me in some way, and my response to which was terror. But I didn't feel that it was a threat. It was just a physiological response. It wasn't a mental fear of, oh my God, what's it going to do, or anything like that. Mentally, I was thinking, this is it. This is one of them. And, you know, here they are. But I'm too terrified to even open my eyes and look. So I had these experiences anyway, various different kinds over the years. post-communion, and I would lucid dream and go looking for them. I would like try and visualize the face of the visitors so that I would bring them into my dreams, and so on and so forth. So that's, I mean, that's kind of been an ongoing thing since that time. That's 25 years ago. And so even when I kind of tried to put my interest in Strieber to bed, I haven't been able to. Like, I wrote that piece in 2008, and then I wrote a second version, extended version, in 2012. I've been trying to put this thing to rest, but I haven't been able to, because it's like the magical thing. If you summon these entities, they eventually they come. They might take a long time, but you can't. It's like an email. You can't call it back once you've sent it. So you might have forgotten about sending it. You might have decided it was a bad idea and you're not interested. But by then it's too late. Like, you've set these forces in motion. And I don't necessarily mean to speak literally, although it could be literally true that I did, you know, all those years of dreaming and invoking and summoning and longing and calling to those entities. You know, that may have literally had some effect, but certainly in terms of my own psyche, I've been trying to come to terms with whatever it is in my own psyche, I guess, my own soul and my own past, that corresponds with the experiences that Strieber has described.
That's the only thing I have, but you have to ask yourself, why would a child's immune system shut down? Okay, now here we go.
As long as I actually don't know what this is, it's like a mystery. Like my dreams, like knowing that there's a mystery there, even knowing that I might never be able to solve it, it's compelling. It's compulsive to actually keep going back to it to try and decipher the riddle. I don't think there are answers, not really. But in terms of my own past, I don't know if it's possible to solve the riddle of one's past, and B, I don't know if even solving it would bring about the results that we hope it would bring about, as in, you know, completeness or fullness or enlightenment or whatever. Because why does a person write to begin with? I mean, anyone who writes, who really writes, does so because they have to, because they're compelled to. And the question of why, it's probably not that relevant, because we're probably compelled to do whatever we're compelled to do for the same reasons, all of us, one way or another. You know, some sort of trauma, some sort of irresolvable tension in the psyche. You know, whatever compels anyone is going to be that, I think. So then it's more of the how. And Whitley Strieber started out as a fiction writer. And he wrote fiction about wolfen and vampires and predatorial superhuman beings, super highly intelligent beings. And then in 85, as he himself has described it, his fiction, his imagination spilled over into his reality, and he became, or he presented himself as a non-fiction writer, but he was still telling the same story. Only now it was non-fiction. So I'd say what happened with Strieber is that he went from writing just ordinary fiction to writing crucial fiction, which is to say, as a writer, he began using his tool, the imagination and the intellect, to create a narrative that would provide him with what he needed to whatever it was, to feel safe, to feel powerful, to feel successful, to feel wise, to feel enlightened, to feel good.
So you think he kind of cornered himself with that now?
Yeah, I do. You can write yourself into a box. Part of how a writer writes themselves into a box is that they naturally enough use writing, they want to use writing to become successful, to become established. Mm-hmm. So, but if you are successful and you do establish yourself, then you, that is a kind of box. I mean, it might be an empire, it might be a palace, but it's still a box of some kind because you become identified with that work, and you're being supported by it. It becomes a structure of support. And I never had that. I mean, I never made enough money from any of my books to think, oh, I need to do that again to keep making the money. And B, I never, say obviously inseparably, I never had a large enough readership to feel like there was any pressure from the world to do, you know, to cater to certain demands. I mean, I try and reduce it to what's actually really happening here, and that's kind of enough of bringing it back to this piece. Why am I doing it? What do I have to gain? Not very much. I mean, no more than I would gain by weeding my garden and just finding out, you know, whether the earth is you know, soft or supple enough to plant in. Well, that actually is quite a big gain, but it's just the real practical everyday challenge of separating our assumptions and our projections and our interpretations from actually what's going on in front of us.
Yeah.
I think that that's just so fundamental to living, getting grounded, you know, getting one's feet on the ground. Well, that is that, and you can't actually take the first step until you've got your feet on the ground.
And yeah.
I think that's where I'm at. Like, I'm still trying to take that first step, in a way. I'm trying to find the ground. You know, see, where is the ground? What's it look like? The bedrock.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, there's two ways to do that. One is, you know, referring to your own inner sense of what's up and what's down. But that's not enough, as we know, because of the delusion aspect. And so then also referring to what's outside and what the indications are from the outside. So checking, always checking with other people. And I think that's what this is bringing it back, just tidily to Whitley. I think that that's the trap that you get into when you write yourself into a box, and then you people relate to the box. They don't relate to what's actually in it, and so you're not able to see the world outside because you're in this box that you've written for yourself, and so you're not getting the feedback that you need to be getting. Like Whitley doesn't want to hear what I have to say. Probably, I mean, I hope I can put it in such a way he will be able to hear it, but because that's, for me, that's the challenge as a writer, to get past his defenses. But in terms of him or anyone, Gordon Ramsay says, you should always listen to your critics because they're the ones who aren't going to bullshit you. Doesn't mean they're right, but it's always worth listening to what they have to say.
Absolutely. I'm happy. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless, but not for long. The future is coming on. I ain't happy. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless, but not for long. The future is coming on. It's coming on. It's coming on. It's coming on. It's coming on.
And this is hard for me. I will honestly tell you this. Everything that involves sexuality is hard for me. And there was a lot of it in my experience with the Greys, far more than I have ever described. And I'm not exactly a prude, but I am a very conventional person. When the world becomes reconciled with the Greys, and by reconciled, they're hard.
I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless. future is coming on. Ain't happy, I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless, but not for long. The future is coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on.
They know absolute morality and they live by it. And it's vividly important to get involved with it and to understand. And you don't have to. I mean, I'm hoping, obviously, at the Stargate, we will have some kind of contact experiences. I can't guarantee it, unfortunately. Knowing the Greys, they'll stay away on purpose because I want them to come. But nevertheless, you can get involved even if you've never had a close encounter experience at all.
Really remember that it's all in your head. Hey, it happened. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless, not for long. The future is coming on. Hey, it happened. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine. It's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on. Our future is coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on. Our future is coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on. Our future is coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on. Our future.
The little farm animal grazing happily, lifts his head and sees the stars. And that's because partly he is drawn by the wonder that they bring, and partly he is forced by the kicks that they give.
I don't believe that for a minute. It's bullshit. How do I know that? Because it is bullshit. Sing that song to somebody else.
It's a feeling of being under absolute control.
I'm really not buying this. You can show me all those little insignia and everything else, and I'm still just not buying it. It's just so fucking strange. Will you stop for a minute, bud? I just can't stand this for a second. I mean, we're going to have to talk about this another time, I think, because I just need a drink.